Future Proof with Jonathan McRae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland
on News Talk.
Hello and welcome to Future Proof, the podcast. This is the show where we take a closer look at the world around us. I'm Jonathan McRae. Before we go into the program, just a note that, you know, I am very enthusiastic about the potential for AI. There is good reason for that. And I think we're at a point now where a lot of the off-the-shelf tools are really, really helpful if you know how to use them. That's what I'm trying to help people to do with an event I'm putting on the 26th of September in Dunleary. We're going to look at how to use things like ChatGPT in a way that is a little bit more advanced. There's no coding involved, but it allows you to interact with ChatGPT and get really amazing results for all sorts of different tasks. It's a hands-on two-hour morning event where we'll go through all the different possibilities, and it will help you just do a lot of the things that you want to do so much quicker. I'll also introduce you to some of my favorite AI tools. Should be a great and fun event. If you want to go, getting started with AI, put that phrase into Eventbrite and you'll get registration and ticket information. Getting started with AI into Eventbrite. Hope to see you there. All right. On this week's episode, we're going to be speaking to neurosurgeon Ted Schwartz. He is a seriously big cheese in the world of neurosurgery, and he's going to be telling us about what really happens in the OR when you undergo brain surgery and how it has improved quite a lot since not so long ago. Do stay with us for that, but just a warning, it is a little grisly, so hope you have the stomach for it or haven't just eaten. If you would like to get in touch with the show, you can email us, science@newstalk.com, or you can tweet us, we're at Newstalk Science. First, though, it's time to look back at the week's science news, and joining me in studio is Dr. Ruth Freeman from Research Ireland and from UCD, Dr. Shane Bergen. Ruth, our first story has to do with the vaccine for lung cancer.
It does. So back in May, we heard about a revolutionary new melanoma vaccine, which was aiming to prevent melanoma reoccurring in patients. So unlike the vaccines that we give kids when they're young, which are preventative vaccines, these are therapeutic vaccines. And we're very much still riding the wave of COVID and the new vaccines that were developed during COVID. So as many people will remember, these are mRNA vaccines, and they were, many of them were encoded towards the spike protein that was found on the outside of the COVID virus. But these are aiming at to look at cancers. And in cancers, what we find on the outside of cancer cells are things called neoantigens. And they're very specific to the cancer cells in the body. So these almost personalized vaccines are being designed for each patient. And so the mRNA inside the vaccine targets the neoantigens in that person's cancer cells. And of course, that's great because unlike other cancer treatments, it's very specific and it's helping the immune system to basically get rid of the cancer using your own immune system. So this vaccine has been developed by BioNTech, who developed some of the COVID vaccines. It's got the catchy title of BNT116. Mm. And the news is that the phase one clinical trial is now starting. It's going to be in 34 different research sites in 7 countries. And the first patient was in the UK, where they're going to have about 20 patients across a range of 6 sites. So obviously the aim of a phase one clinical trial is to see, is the vaccine safe? Is it well tolerated with other chemotherapies and other medications? And is it actually effective at preventing recurrence of non-small cell lung cancer, which is the type of lung cancer that's been targeted?
You said it's personalised, but the COVID vaccine wasn't personalised at all. We got the same shot. So what's the difference there?
Well, a lot of cancers are heterogeneous. So what you find is a mixture of different types of cancer cells, even in one tumour. And that's been one of the challenges, I suppose, in dealing with cancer and why we've had to use quite blunt instruments in killing cancer cells.
Because people have this idea that cancer is one type of a cell, but actually it's a whole bunch of different cells. They have their own genomes.
Exactly. And that's why a lot of kind of now what we would say some of the more primitive cancer treatments just target fast growing cells or cells that are turning over quickly. One of the other things to mention is the reason why patients in the UK are getting access to this is because I think the National Health Service in the UK has been quite foresighted in that they've made arrangements with a lot of the companies that are developing these, that if patients are willing to sign up and be part of the trial, it does mean giving a sample, making sure they're suitable, but they're getting fast tracked onto these trials. Now, we have a pretty good track record here in Ireland of getting people on to early stage trials.
Do we?
Yeah, we do. We've had, particularly actually with cancer, you know, we've with a lot of the pharma companies here, we've managed to get people on trials. But it's often driven by, you know, a small number of really committed clinicians who are research active, and that's how you get onto trials. So it also underlines that link between the best healthcare for citizens and research active doctors and health professionals who are able to link in with the trials, give the right kind of data back to the trials, and have also facilities where people can get these kind of medications. Because, you know, you need to get 6 consecutive injections over 5 minutes apart, over 30 minutes initially, and then every week you're going in to get extra injections. So this is, you know, it's not sort of healthcare as we know it in many ways.
Animal models must have been positive if we're doing phase 1 clinical trials in humans?
Yeah. I mean, they didn't detail what animal models they'd done in this paper, but yeah, that would normally happen before you go into any human trial.
Yeah, amazing. Okay, our second story, Shane, has to do with obesity.
Yes, by 2030, 20% of the world's population will live with obesity, which is a staggering number.
Does that factor in, like, drugs? Like Wegovy and all these sort of things?
Not clear, actually, yeah. But there's a lot of talk, as you just mentioned there, about treatments that are available. And even the positioning of it now, we call obesity a disease as opposed to something because you ate too much. And success, though, when we come to the various treatments, be they surgical or pharmacological, tends to be based on things like BMI, body mass index, or percentage weight loss. They're very, very crude. And so research is needed and has been done to understand really what success means for people living with obesity. And that's the work that I'm talking about today. It's led by Emma Farrell. Full disclosure, Emma's my wife, and she published 3 papers in recent weeks looking at the lived experience of people with obesity. Emma's a psychologist, so she was interested in what they thought success meant. And she used something called hermeneutic phenomenology to find out.
Do, 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 do.
That's every time she says it, I do that. Yeah. So she asked what success looks like for them. And they said 3 things. And they are obvious, but they're startling too, because it's not often that people living with conditions or diseases are asked what they think about things. It's kind of shocking, but it doesn't happen a lot. The first thing they said was...
Because a lot of the time it's focused on, what's the number?
Exactly.
Did I get the number down? Because the number is important for clinical trials,
yes.
or, you know, data. You say, we got this number down to this number, and that is proof of the thing that works.
And it's why medicine is as much an art as it is a science, because the science can only get you so far, but people are involved and they have to, you know, it's complex. So freedom for people living with obesity would be freedom from stigma, right? That's one thing. The mental burden of living with the condition. Another,
and we know a lot about that this week.
Yeah.
like the story of the woman who was refused the ability to foster a child because
absolutely
of her BMI number.
Yeah, which is nuts. Being able to participate fully in the world, like, so just, you know, being able to do things, to go out, to be able to go on the bus, to be able to sit in an aeroplane seat. All of these things are sort of non-conventional, but they are real markers of success for people that live with obesity. So it's really important to consider the psychology of these things as well as the medicinal. Emma also looked at how personalised medicine is seen as the future of treatment. And she asked people about the views that they have, the potential they see for personalised medicine. The first thing is that they felt that it would really help with stigma and increase public understanding. It could lead to increased early intervention, right? And it would really empower people because the issue would be seen less as a moral one, right, and more as a medical one. And so what people are saying in this study is that they really do feel judged by society for living with obesity.
Absolutely. And the medical community does have a role to play in that, because for a long time it was seen as, you know, the way we think about obesity is calories in, calories out, you're eating too much, not doing enough exercise.
And see now everything you say when you go to the doctor's going to say, well, you need to lose weight and then I'll talk to you.
Yeah.
Now, every doctor doesn't say that, but it can be a mindset that persists. The last part is about range of treatments and ask people what... They thought about getting more people into the treatments. And it's incredible there. But one of the things that they said might hold people back, and this is very interesting, is people living with obesity worry if they lose all the weight, will they lose themselves? Because it's such a radical change to their sense of self that they mightn't recognize themselves anymore. And that's profound.
I mean, a huge weight loss does change the way a person appears in a room. I mean, that's absolutely true. And some people have lost a lot of weight, and it is, you know, the difference is really startling. Would you call this a good paper, Shane? Would you say this is good quality science that your wife did?
The best paper you've read this year.
I don't want to hear anything about media bias or preferential treatment ever again on this program.
Well, if I could publish 3 papers in a month, I think I'd be doing pretty well too.
Right. I noticed you're not rubbishing the field of psychology this week. It's interesting. Right, let's move on. Ruth, our third story is a really interesting one. It has to do with a fundamental new discovery about our planet.
It does. And actually, when Shane and I were talking before we came in here, Shane said, they might get the Nobel Prize for this. So I think it's actually a seriously important piece of science. And it's about the ambipolar electric field. And we sort of need to come back to, let's come back. Let's start with the atmosphere. So we know we have the atmosphere wrapped around the Earth. And the reason why we have the atmosphere is, you know, gravity essentially holds the atmosphere down. And when the Earth was formed, we have all the heavy bits in the middle and it gradually gets lighter as you go out to the outside, if we keep it simple. And generally, you know, gravity is keeping that atmosphere in, and it doesn't have a definitive boundary where it ends. But certainly as you know, and that idea that the lightest things are at the outside, it's not really true, because of course you have UV radiation and heat and all sorts of things are happening in the atmosphere. And certainly as the molecules all move around, some of them escape out into outer space. But more escape than kind of should be escaping, if you know what I mean. So we lose about 90 tons of atmosphere into space every year. And most of that is going out through the poles. So for many, many years, we have seen that when you fly, spacecraft flying over the poles can see this stream of kind of ions, plasma, pouring out of our atmosphere into space. And this has been sort of, it's a leak, like the pressure is too high at that end of the balloon, called the polar wind. So it was hypothesized more than 60 years ago that some kind of electrical field must have been in place drawing these ions out into the atmosphere. And the idea was that it would end, this field started about 250 kilometers up into space, where molecules break into positively charged ions and negatively charged electrons. And of course, the electrons are incredibly light. They're trying to float up into space, and the ions are heavy and they're trying to sink with gravity. So the electrical field that's created between this push and pull, it's a bi-directional electric field, is what's happening here. But that pull upwards is essentially extending the height of our ionosphere, that ion charged bit of our atmosphere. So it's sort of pulling particles up towards the top of the atmosphere. But we never knew whether it existed or not. But published this week in Nature, we have the evidence that it does. So NASA went up to Svalbard in Norway, and they sent a rocket up into this part of the atmosphere. And over the course of a kind of 500 kilometre altitude change, they measured whether there was a change in charge. And they found a small change, only 0.5 volts in the change of electrical potential. But that fits all the models. So it's only about as much electrical charge as you get out of a little watch battery, but it's enough to give, to fight against gravity and allow those particles to flow up towards the top of the atmosphere. So this is a really...
So we never knew, measured an electrical field around
and
the Earth.
Just to put this into context, there's two other electrical fields, gravity and magnetism, that's very much at the heart of physics. So this is now the third global electrical field. And it has probably played a massive role in creating our planet, our oceans, understanding our atmosphere. So there's great excitement now as to what we're going to learn from now on.
See, physics is great.
Okay, very good.
How did I do, Shane, on physics?
How does it compare to psychology?
I will stay quiet.
Our final story has to do with WIMPs, Shane.
It does, yeah. The hunt for the WIMPs, right? So we're talking about dark matter, which we've mentioned on the show many times before. So
I'm going to be proven right on this one.
Why? What have you been...
Dark matter doesn't exist.
Doesn't exist. So we can see the effects of something that we're calling dark matter, right? You're right. It doesn't exist until we found it, incidentally. So they've been looking for it. And one of the three big experiments to do that is a $55 million detector that's 1.4 kilometres underground in South Dakota, big tank of something called xenon, and it's looking for weakly interacting massive particles, or WIMPs, and it's thought that they are the matter that might account for this extra pull in the universe. This new detector.
So this is a, like we've heard on this program, some of these amazing experiments underground.
Yes.
Just a huge field of gas hoping to have the slightest of interaction
Absolutely.
With these tiny particles that will give us some hint of the existence of this thing called dark.
It would be the briefest of flashes, and that's why they use xenon, because it'll flash if something interacts with it like a wimp. It's really sensitive, this particular tank, and that's why...
Don't call it a wimp then. I mean, like, that's obvious, right? Like, don't call it a wimp.
Sensitive.
It's very sensitive. They speculate that the mass of a wimp would be between 10 proton masses and 1,000. So protons are the kind of core unit of atoms. And they've run the experiment for 280 days and they've seen nothing, right? But they're going to keep running it until 2028. They have even put in false kind of fake signals into it just to see if they would see them. And they did every time. So the thing is working, right? But they haven't seen anything.
Someone has forgotten to carry the one. I'm telling you, when it comes to dark matter, dark energy, I really feel that at the end of the day, we're going to find out that someone has forgotten something and it isn't. We don't need dark matter or dark energy to... uncrack the standard model. That is my
the Nobel
my
Prize goes to
but no, I don't think. Yeah, I'd love it if you got Nobel prizes for just like hunches for the Nobel hunch.
The Nobel hunch.
The Nobel hunch.
On the show. Yeah, absolutely.
I won't go on about that time that I said something to Watson and he made a fool of me in front of a whole festival and I turned out to be right and you know he obviously found the structure of DNA. But you know I'm not going to go on about that. But you know. That
not sensitive helped. About it. You're not wimpy about it even, are you? Yeah.
Right. Thank you very much, Dr. Shane Bergen and Dr. Ruth Freeman. All right, on the way, we're not pulling any punches with this one. I'm just going to warn you now, it is a little grisly. We're going to be talking about what actually happens when you have brain surgery. Now, it wasn't that long ago that when you walked in to a hospital to get brain surgery, you had a 50% chance of dying. And yet, in the past 130 years, we have dramatically increased outcomes and transformed what it's like to have your brain opened up by a doctor. This is a fascinating area, and a book covers it so well. It's called Gray Matters, A Biography of Brain Surgery. It's by Dr. Theodore Schwartz. He's the David and Ursula Barnes Endowed Professor of Minimally Invasive Neurosurgery at Weill Cornell Medicine. And he joins me now. I want to start off, Ted, if that's okay, talking a little bit about, you know, the early days of brain surgery and how it was performed and what the outcomes were like, if that's okay.
Sure. So when the field began, which was around the turn of the century, the mortality rate, as you said, from brain surgery was about 50%, which was really shocking. And there was a guy named Harvey Cushing, who's considered the founder of modern neurosurgery, who published the first paper on the field in 1905, and that really was kind of our official birth certificate. Back then, we would make holes in the skull with handheld drills that we would rotate with our hands, putting pressure on them, and the skull was removed by passing a wire with teeth on it, almost like a chainsaw dental floss, from burr hole to burr hole, and just sweeping your hands back and forth and pulling up to make those cuts. So it would take a bit of time, but surgeons would get very facile at doing it quickly. And when Harvey Cushing was done with his career in the 1930s, 1940s, the mortality rate of brain surgery came down to 8% because he was so fastidious and meticulous and so talented and dedicated and stubborn that he didn't let the frequent deaths that occurred deter him and dissuade him, because most surgeons at that time thought it really was futile to go in and do this kind of surgery because you would do more harm than good. And by the end of that period of time, brain surgeons were now doing more good than harm, and patients were better off after their surgeries than they were before them.
Did Cushing and his colleagues at the time have any idea of what they were going to find when they opened up the brain? Because there was no scanning at that time, obviously. So how would they know where to enter? What sort of information were they working off? And how would they know what to treat, considering half of the patients died in the surgeries before that?
Well, the good news was they get a lot of autopsies, right? So they could confirm what they thought was going on. But there was something called a neurologic exam. So they would examine their patients and talk to their patients, and their patients would say, well, you know, I'm having trouble moving my right arm. So they would know that the tumor or whatever the problem was on the left side of the brain. It was near the part of the brain that moved the right arm. And they had some basic understanding of what parts of the brain did, although it was very rudimentary. And so a lot of the early surgeries were really exploratory before we had CAT scans, MRI scans. And then there was a period of time in the 1950s where other tests were developed involving x-rays, where you could inject air into the head to get outlines or silhouettes of some of the anatomy and do an x-ray, or you could inject a dye into the blood vessels also to get the outline of the blood vessels. And again, we had these rudimentary tests that surgeons were going by and associating those with the physical examination of the patients to try to figure out what exactly they were dealing with, which is one of the reasons that brain surgery was so risky back in the first half of the century.
Following on from Cushing's sort of exploratory, and you said quite brave work, which I want to talk about, you know, the bravery of neurosurgery in a bit. But following that, you know, we started to get imaging, which gave neurosurgeons a really good idea of what was going on inside the head. Those hand drills presumably gave way to less crude methods, because I presume if you were hand drilling the side of someone's skull, it slips every once in a while. You know, you go through too far. Like I've done that with a power tool in my shed, and there's a big hole where the bathroom is. I mean, that presumably happens, and that's usually game over for that patient, is it? Or,
well, it could happen. If you were skilled, it would happen very rarely, but for sure, you have to know when to stop. And believe it or not, you know, I'm 59 years old. When I started my training, that is still how I learned how to open the skull, was to use what's called a Hudson brace. That's right. And interestingly, power drills were brought into neurosurgery very early by French physicians, and they were not accepted in the United States because Harvey Cushing did not like the idea of using that kind of a drill, and he preferred the pulling out method with the giggly saw. And so in the U.S., we were very late to adopt the electronic and mechanical drills. But now, of course, we have air-powered or mechanically powered, electrically powered tools that rotate bits 10,000 times per second. We can very quickly drill through the head. You can almost paint away the skull like a sculptor would paint away marble with a power tool, and then quickly use a handheld drill to connect the holes and rapidly open up the skull very, very safely without damaging the underlying brain.
To get into the brain, do you always go through the same part of the skull? And do you need to take away like a section, or can you work through a little tiny keyhole to get in and around? Because you still need to get to the part of the brain you want to operate on, and that isn't always necessarily on the surface, or is that usually where you will find it?
No. We go everywhere and anywhere, and every approach is slightly different. So we don't go in through the same corridor. In fact, one of the things that it takes the longest time to learn as a trainee in brain surgery is what approach am I going to use to get where I need to get? And one of the things that we have developed over time are less and less invasive ways of doing that. So the holes that we make in the skull have become progressively smaller and smaller as technology increases, as we have more information before we go in. And now, rather than making big holes on the side of the head, we can go in through the nostrils, for example, using endoscopes, which are long, thin telescopes, and take out brain tumors without making any incisions whatsoever, or make small incisions in the eyelid or the eyebrow to work under the brain or around the eye to get to places that previously required these sort of massive openings on the side of the head and dismantling the muscles for chewing on the side of the head. So every approach is different, and part of the skill of the brain surgeon is figuring out how am I going to get in and out safely, doing as little damage as possible.
People have this idea of neurosurgery being this very precise and delicate thing, and I want to talk about that in a moment, but I was present at a cochlear implant operation, and I was horrified at the brutality of, you know, getting in there. You know, the bone saw and the drills, when they go, you know, you can smell, you know, it has a pretty full-on visceral feeling when you're in the room there. I mean, can you paint the picture for what it might look like for someone in the room?
Yeah, absolutely. And I try to do this in the book as well, to bring people into the operating room and sort of lift up the operating room drapes. But, you know, the getting in and the getting out can be fairly gruesome and brutal, right? Because you have to cut through the skin, which is highly, highly vascular, and control the bleeding of the scalp. then there's usually muscles that you have to cut through. And we do that with a knife that burns. And you can literally smell the smoke almost like you're at a barbecue, because you're basically cooking meat as you cut through the side of the head, right? Which is why we try to avoid that now by doing approaches that are less invasive. And then you come to the skull, and the skull requires power tools. And as you drill with those tools, you will often see smoke going up in the air, not just from the tool and the heat generated with the tool, the metal against the bone, but little bits of bone will actually fly up like mist into the sky. And you can smell that. There's a distinct smell to that, which is what you're referring to. So the first part of neurosurgery is actually, you know, can be fairly gruesome and brutal. On the other hand, if we're going through a small incision in the eyelid, it can be very meticulous with very little blood and very little drilling, which is why we try to do these minimally invasive approaches when we can. That said, once the brain is exposed, we bring in a microscope or an endoscope. And so we magnify what we're doing, and we sit in a chair that almost looks like an astronaut in a cockpit, looking into this microscope with our arms that are being supported by the chair's arms. So we have no tremor, right? We need to minimize our tremor as best we can. We need to hold our arms out in front of us for as long, long periods of time. And that part of the operation is very delicate and very precise and very meticulous. And that's where we're manipulating instruments that can be 6 or 7 inches long, whose tips can be the size of insect legs, you know, just really microscopic, and working in areas the size of a postage stamp. You know, you could spend the next 2 hours of your day basically working in this tiny, tiny little region down in a deep corridor. And if you see a neurosurgeon operating that way, it will look like they're not moving at all, because the only thing that's moving is the tips of their fingers as they manipulate these very delicate instruments microscopically in the depths of the brain. The rest of their body is just completely still and motionless. And every once in a while, they'll reach out their arm to exchange one instrument for another, and the nurse will hand them that, and they'll proceed.
Wow, that's a really vivid picture you've painted there. Presumably, that tremor is now further reduced by... is there machinery that makes your movements a little bit slower and more precise? Are robotics now just even taking over that assisted level?
So no, it's really something you have to train yourself to do. That is part of the physicality and the training of brain surgery. It's still like an artisan or a watchmaker. It's something that we learn to do by doing these delicate procedures, you know, many times per week for hours a day, over decades of our craft. And we have special techniques to reduce our tremor. For example, when I'm doing something very, very delicate, I will unconsciously hold my breath and not breathe for that moment of time while I'm making that move. I will also brace my pinky or the instrument against the side of the skull. You know, the closer you are to the instrument where you have the bracing, the less tremor you're going to have, right? The tremor comes more from your shoulder and from your elbows than it does from your fingertips. So you want to brace as much of your hand as possible on something as you're doing your operation to reduce your tremor. And then, of course, there's a physiologic tremor that we all have. And every once in a while, you'll see a resident come through the training program and you'll see them put the instruments in there and they'll be just like wildly moving back and forth. And you'll say, oh my goodness, like this person is never going to be a great neurosurgeon. You know, they'll maybe do some simpler procedures, but they just don't have what it takes. And then there are other surgeons who just move their hands beautifully. But the physical part of it is part of it, but the mental part is very, very important as well, because every one of those little moves that you do under the microscope, there's a mind there judging, what can I do? What can I get away with? How firmly can I move this blood vessel without damaging it? And these are like blood vessels the size of hairs. You know, and it's very, very delicate movements, and you have to have experience and judgment on top of the physicality to make a great brain surgeon.
What are you doing when you're actually performing brain surgery? Is it typically removal of tumors? I mean, what other neurosurgery operations are there?
So most neurosurgeons, the most common neurosurgical operation, believe it or not, is spine surgery. So if you go to the average neurosurgeon in the community, they'll be doing 70% spine operations, discs, things like that. There are some of us who specialize just in doing brain surgery, and I'm one of those surgeons, and those are mostly at major academic centers, larger centers. And then among us brain surgeons, there are subspecialties. So I do mostly brain tumors and epilepsy. I have partners who do nothing but blood vessel problems. They'll clip aneurysms and arteriovenous malformations. I have other partners who do nothing but pediatric neurosurgery. So they only operate on children. And there are obviously traumatic cases that we do where we're evacuating blood clots and hematomas. And then we have another whole specialty of neurosurgery called functional neurosurgery, where we're implanting electrodes in the brain. We're treating Parkinson's disease, movement disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder. And now we're starting to treat things like depression, anxiety, obesity, because we're now learning that we can manipulate the ability of the brain to process information, which means we can change people's personalities and their behaviors.
How hard is brain surgery? Like, you know, it's the rocket science and brain surgery kind of come hand in hand as the two right. most difficult things in the world. Is rocket science harder or?
Well, no one knows the answer to that question. So believe it or not, there was a study published in the British Medical Journal, something, I think that's the name of it. Anyway, they looked at the IQs of rocket scientists, neurosurgeons, and the average population. And they basically found out that we're no smarter than everybody else. And I talk in the very beginning of the book about the myth of the brain surgeon and why we have this myth that it's not brain surgery. And that really goes back to the days of Harvey Cushing, who really was a brilliant innovator and pioneer. He also, by the way, won the Pulitzer Prize for a biography of one of his teachers that he wrote. So he really was quite a talented individual. And neurosurgery is something that is very difficult. But what makes brain surgery so hard nowadays is that it requires, first of all, an enormous amount of sacrifice, right? You're giving up your whole 20s to be in the hospital to learn how to do it. And then for the rest of your life, you are on call for emergencies whenever they come in. Whatever is going on in your life, if you're on call, you have to run into the hospital and take care of patients. So there's an element of sacrifice. There's also an enormous psychological burden of having someone come into the hospital with a significant, serious problem and them trusting you with their lives.
There's obviously inherent risk in the work that you do. How do you go about doing it? Because you talked about, the new neurosurgeon trainees who come in and they do a terrible job. I mean, often there's a human at the end of that, right? How do you try a new procedure that you've never done before with confidence when it's someone's brain that you're working with? And what happens when that goes wrong?
Well, that's really what makes brain surgery so difficult. And that's really the biggest challenge. People think of brain surgery as being an intellectually difficult task. It's not that intellectually difficult once you have mastered the field. The hardest part is the psychological burden, which is that another human being is trusting you, not just with their lives, but with their selves and their ability to function, move their arm, see, smell, speak. And the surgeries we do can have profound impacts on another human being's life and their capacity. So that's an enormous burden. Now, it goes well most of the time. And so I don't want to get people scared of brain surgery, right? Our outcomes are remarkably good in the year 2024. And the majority, vast majority of people who get on a operating room table with a brain tumor problem or a brain situation having brain surgery will come off that table better off, much better off than they were when they got on the table. However, there are still cases that we do that are extremely difficult, extremely complicated, problems where the chance of success is low. And the reason we do the operations is that the chance of them getting worse without the operation is enormously high, right? So these are people that if we don't operate on them, they will go blind. They will lose their ability to speak. They will die of their tumor. They're facing an inevitability that's horrible. So we're willing to take more risk in patients like that to do surgeries to try to help them. And often those surgeries will go well, but sometimes they won't because they're so difficult. So there is a psychological burden of taking that on and essentially failing, right? Because when you take on a task that's incredibly hard and you're a human being and you're not perfect, you will fail some of the time, no matter how good you are. And so we go in, certain days of the week knowing that we're just not going to measure up because what the thing we're facing is so hard on that day, that we're going to come out of the back end feeling like we've let someone else down. And that is incredibly difficult for us to do as surgeons and as doctors, because all we want to do is help people, right? We went into this profession to try to make people better. But sometimes when you face such a daunting task that is so demanding of you, you're not going to perform perfectly, and you're not going to have a perfect outcome every time. Sometimes the disease is just too devastating.
I mean, like, when that happens, do you, like, if someone someone dies, or if someone loses, you know, a major function of their body that they didn't, you know, that wasn't on the table, is that, what is it like to come back from that?
Well, it's devastating. And we talk about emotional armor, right? And compartmentalization. Those are the terms that are bandied about how surgeons deal with these things. We have to erect walls, because you can have a horrible operation in the morning, and God forbid something horrible goes on, and then you have a second operation to do that afternoon. You have another person who's depending on you, and you can't ground the airplane and just say, "Hey, I don't feel like flying today." You know that you have to, you know, look within yourself and have the strength to put that patient first and that next individual first, and your own psychological issues behind you for that period of time, but. You will be thinking about that patient for the rest of your life if something goes wrong. These problems weigh on us, but we have to compartmentalize them, because we have to keep doing what we do, because we've spent all these years to gain this skill. And it's very, very difficult. It's difficult not to bring it home and not to burden your family with it. But that's the emotional compartmentalization we do. But the key is to be able to do that and still have emotional flexibility, so you don't become a robot. Because at the same time, you have to be a human being with your patients. You have to be sensitive. You have to take care of them. You have to give them the humanity and the care that they need, because they're going through such difficult times. But then when you go into the operating room, you essentially close all that off and turn into a mechanical robot to perform at your highest ability.
I wanted to finish off looking at the future, and this is a really crazy time we live in, that there are so many advances both in AI imaging and robotics and different techniques to improve surgery. I'm wondering what sort of techniques and advances in your field have been a real eye-opener in the last couple of years, and where, what do you think the future approach to neurosurgery might look like?
So, you know, right now we're using more and more robotics to help us. They're not replacing us, but they're helping us be more efficient. We have robots that now will, you know, place electrodes in the brain. There's still a human being making a lot of the decisions and doing part of the surgery. We have lasers that we can implant in the brain to heat up in ablate tissue. We can use ultrasound waves to pass through the skull without opening up the brain at all. And we can take someone who has a horrible tremor and make a small, small lesion in their brain with the ultrasound waves and essentially eliminate their tremor without opening up their skull. And then, you know, one of the most exciting things that I'm involved in and interested in is the field of brain-computer interfaces. And that's our ability to implant a computer and wires in the brain and interface the human brain with a computer, which will create the ability for telepathy and telekinesis. Essentially, someone in a wheelchair can, with their thoughts only, control a computer. If they can't move their arm, they can move a robotic arm just by thinking about it. They can express their speech by thinking about what they want to say, and those words will come out on a screen, or a robot can speak their words. And that is really remarkable. And we're just at the cusp of a revolution in our human abilities in the form of brain-computer interfaces. And brain surgeons are going to be the gatekeepers for all of that technology, which is very, very exciting.
And we're reading more and more advances in that over the last number of years. It's incredible to see that field take off. Very quickly, Ted, would you recommend that someone take up a career as a neurosurgeon?
So I would recommend that if you are passionate about it and you understand what it's about, and I try to outline it, you know, very explicitly in my book, so anyone who's interested can read that and understand it. Absolutely. I mean, it's an enormous sacrifice, but once you're at the end of that road and you've learned what to do and you're in the midst of the practice of it, it is an incredibly rewarding field. I mean, I joke with my partners that, you know, to some extent it's the best job in the world. People who love doing it really, really love doing it. But it is not a side gig. It's not a hobby. It is a full-time passion. You have to do it because you love it. You don't go into it because you want to have a nice salary and a comfortable life. That is not the brain surgeon. And if you are that person who has the passion, understand what it's about, 100%.
Really, really interesting speaking with you, and great to get an insight of what it might be to live the life of a neurosurgeon. This is covered really well in the book. It's really descriptive and gives you a great sense of both the history of what brain surgery looks like and what it looks like today, and how do you become the best of the best and get into neurosurgery. Well, the book is called Gray Matters, A Biography of Brain Surgery. It's by Ted Schwartz. Ted, thanks so much for your time.
Jonathan, thank you.
It is kind of a mad job, isn't it? And it's kind of interesting because, you know, you can totally understand why you would have a God complex. I'm not saying that Ted has, but you can totally understand when you have that much of a control over somebody that you're literally drilling into their brain and you can save them from a horrible condition or they could die. Like, you can understand why that is that's not a hobby. That is you are giving your entire life to do that. And man, like 4 years and another 6 years after university, like you're talking about a lot to get to what everyone else is doing, let alone be someone like Ted, who is sort of, you know, driven forward in the area. So really interesting. Love to know your thoughts on that. And if it was a little bit too much, do let us know as well. That's it from us, I think, on this week's podcast. Aidan McKelvey's away. So Simon Keane was producing. We'll be back with more Future Proof in your podcast feed on Tuesday. Thanks to Hugo da Silva on sound as well. I'll see you next time. In the meantime, stay curious.
Future Proof with Jonathan McCrae.
Proudly supported by Science Foundation Ireland.
Sunday morning at 10 on News Talk.